This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about women who've had an impact on Indiana's history and culture. We'll start out with one you may have seen painted on the side of a building on Massachusetts Avenue in Indianapolis. To learn more, we're joined by Nichelle Hayes, founding director of the Center for Black Literature and Culture at the Indianapolis Public Library. Thank you so much for joining us, Nichelle.
Thank you, Miriam. It's an honor to be here.
Let's talk about this mural on Massachusetts Avenue. Who is the woman in that mural?
So the woman in that mural is Mari Evans. So she lived here in Indianapolis since about 1947. Miss Mari Evans was a mother, a scholar, professor, artist, musician, activist, humanitarian, and of course, a poet. So I think you can succinctly say that she was a Renaissance woman.
Yeah, that's amazing to be able to have all of those talents. And can you tell us a little bit more about who Mari was and what I guess, I mean, there's so many things about her. So what would you say she's most known for?
I would say that she's most known for her poetry. And as far as being in Indianapolis, being an activist and someone who spoke out against injustice, she was also a fierce defender of children and people that were in need. She wrote an essay in 1988 for the Indiana Humanities Council titled Where We Live. And she said, "What we find is that racism in this up south city at the end of the 20th century is like a steel strand encased in nylon, then covered in some luxurious fabric. The intent is to avoid, if possible, blatant offenses, to soothe, mollify, if necessary, and disassemble, while racism, the steel strand, still effectively does the job." So she was not afraid to speak out and speak truth to power.
That's very powerful. Like, I have goosebumps on my arm right now, just hearing that line. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, is she someone that we hear about at all in history courses or learning about Indiana, or has that not been mentioned before?
Miriam, that's a great question. And I think that what happens oftentimes is that in your hometown, people don't see you as a significant person that you are, but outside in the United States and even in the world, she was definitely seen as a powerhouse. In Uganda, her likeness was on a stamp in 1997. She was inducted into the National Literary Hall of Fame in 1998. So she has done some incredible work. She was a professor here in Indiana as well as Georgia. And so she did a lot of great work, but I would like to tout her more in Indianapolis so she would not be an unknown quantity.
Absolutely. And I think it's important, you know, for young girls growing up to see someone who, as you said, was a Renaissance woman who did all of these things and more.
Most definitely. And she was a person of the people. She was with us. She was concerned about us. And she fought for us. And I think that's very, very important. And she did that into her last days.
What were the common themes that she wrote about? I know you mentioned she did poetry. Did she write anything else aside from poetry?
She did poetry. She wrote a musical play, which was an adaptation of Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. And then she also did a choral poem, River of My Song, as well as a one-woman play. So it's almost easier to say, what didn't she do?
Yeah.
But she was a huge part of the Black Arts Movement. And so the Black Arts Movement was celebrating and advancing Black civil rights, as well as advancing Black self-determination, political beliefs, and then political action while utilizing Black arts and culture. And so she was a huge person in that movement, along with Nikki Giovanni, Maya Angelou, Sonia Sanchez, and Hakeem Abudi, just to name a few.
What work of Mari Evans do you have at the Center for Black Literature and Culture?
So we have a lot of her work, and she didn't just write for adults. She also wrote for children. So she's got several children's books. Just a couple of those titles are I'm Late and Jim Flying High, and those pieces can be checked out at the Indianapolis Public Library. Her book Continuum is a very powerful one, as well as Clarity as Concept. So we have everything that you can possibly obtain of Miss Mari Evans at the Center for Black Literature and Culture.
Did Mari Evans have a relationship with the Indianapolis Public Library?
She did have a relationship. She actually volunteered for us for 16 years in our bookstore. And that was something that was very important to her. And we appreciated so much her giving back to the community in that way. And she also, again, was never afraid to speak truth to power. So she thought we were weeding books that didn't need to be weeded, including her own. She was definitely clear to speak out on that. So she was someone that I look up to and look as a model for using your voice in a positive way.
And it sounds like she used arts and culture to amplify the cause and her voice and things like that. Can you tell us a little bit more about her work as an activist for the Black community in Indiana?
Yes, I think that her poems definitely were powerful and they spoke volumes, but also her work within the community and within other community organizations. She was a woman of faith, so she attended church regularly, and she liked to work within those environments to make the community better. If she saw someone in need, she would do what she could to help without any fanfare or adulation. It was just something that she wanted to do. And she didn't do it because it made her feel good. She did it because that's what needed to be done. And I think that's something that we can really learn from right now. There are so many needs that we have in our community, and the person in the mirror is the person that can do those things. And she showed us that in a big way.
What influence did she have on the Black art movement in the 60s and 70s?
She had a big influence. She influenced Nikki Giovanni, as I said before. She was peers with Sonia Sanchez, Etheridge Knight, as well as Hakeem Abudi. Sonia Sanchez and Hakeem Abudi came and spoke at her funeral services. And she was really a bright and shining star and someone that showed how the pen really is mightier than the sword. Because even though she's passed away in 2017, her words are powerful and they still live on, and they can inspire us to do the work that we must still do.
How do Black artists feel inspired by her? I mean, is she still someone that people think about and talk about in the work that she's done?
Yes, I believe so. January York, who is a local poet, and she's the first Center for Black Literature and Culture poet laureate, she marks Miss Mari Evans as a huge influence on her. And she was a mentor to her, and she encouraged her. And so she's just one of many poets who was inspired by Miss Mari Evans. And she continues to inspire poets.
Is there anything about Mari Evans' work that you wish more people knew about?
I think I would like them to know about her depth, and that's why I wanted to talk about the fact that she did plays, she did texts for music with David Baker, she was an activist. Again, like I said, I think it would be easier to say what she didn't do versus what she did. And so she's so expansive, and there's so much for us to learn. Another one of her books was Clarity as Concept. And then another one was Night Star, one of her earlier books. So I think we can learn a lot from it. And I think if we take each one of her books and kind of dig deep into it and see what it's saying to us today, because I think they're still very, very relevant.
And I think for myself, just hearing all of this, I'm extremely inspired and want to learn more right now. So we're gonna cancel the show, and I'm gonna go and get some more knowledge. But really, I mean, what a fascinating and remarkable woman, and the things that you mentioned, writing plays, and then there's music, and then there's poems, and there's activism. I think she just shows that when you I guess go for what you believe in, there's nothing that can stop you.
Most definitely. And as I said before, she was a mother and a grandmother. And so she really encompassed all that she could be in doing them all in an excellent way. And I think she's very inspiring for me, I know personally.
There was an Indy Star article about Evans in 2017 that said, although Evans may not have been as well known among Hoosiers, her influence was deeply felt on education, literature, and Black culture in the state and nation. And I know we kind of touched upon this in the beginning. Do you think it's fair to say that she wasn't well known among Hoosiers?
I think that she wasn't well known among certain Hoosiers. Mm-hmm. Definitely in the Black arts community here in Indianapolis, she was well known and revered. I think in the greater community, not as much. And that is something that I am trying to remedy in small part with the platform that I've been given at the Center for Black Literature and Culture. So I want to speak her name so that she will continue to live on. And so if you come into our space at Central Library, 40 East St. Clair Street, you can see a huge image of Miss Mari Evans. And even beyond that, you can dig into her collection. And then we also have some items on our website and in the kiosk where you can learn more about her.
Earlier, we mentioned Mari Evans has a mural dedicated to her on Massachusetts Avenue. I almost feel like I shouldn't even ask this question because we know that she's remarkable. But what do you think made Evans so special to the community of Indianapolis?
Well, when I heard the artist speak about the honor of creating that mural, and it really is bigger than life. She's a giant figure there. And I think that's a very accurate depiction of who she was, because she was a giant walking amongst us. And as I said before, she was a poet, a scholar, but she was also a humanitarian. She cared about people. So even if she had never written a word, her care for the community is so important, and it still lives on. And I think that is her biggest legacy, her care for the community and her family.
What's next for the Center for Black Literature and Culture? What do you have planned?
So we're always working on different things. So we're going to be having an Etheridge Night youth poetry workshop in May. We're also going to be having Juneteenth on Saturday, June 18th. So we're doing things constantly. And so you can always go to ndpl.org and look on our calendar to see the things that we have upcoming.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Nichelle. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for all the insight.
Thank you so much.
Nichelle M. Hayes, the founding director of the Center for Black Literature and Culture at the Indianapolis Public Library. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the significant figures in Indiana women's history. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You could also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today, we're talking about significant women in Indiana's history. And with us now are two guests, Michelle Marino, Deputy Director for the Indiana Historical Bureau, and Jill Wee Simmons, Staff Historian for the Indiana Historical Bureau. Thank you both so much for joining us today. Michelle, I'll start with you. The first woman I'm hoping that we can talk about is Melba Phillips. And if you can give us a little background about who she was and the work she did as a physicist.
Thanks, Miriam. We're both really excited to be here, but I'm actually going to turn this one over to Jill, who's an expert on Phillips.
Hi, thanks for having me. So Melba Phillips was a pioneer of nuclear physics in a really exciting age for physics. She was a passionate educator who influenced students that went on to do great things in the field. And in the wake of World War II and the atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped on Japan, she was an activist for peace and peaceful use of atomic energy. So a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, can you work in that field and then also want peace?
Yeah, so after the war, a lot of the Manhattan scientists and other people involved in pushing the technology that did drive the war and then ultimately the atomic bombs. Some people retreated to academia, feeling a lot of remorse for their role, and some people became more politically active. And Melba Phillips was in the second category, helping to organize the Federation of American Scientists in 1945 to advocate for the peaceful use of nuclear technology and put pressure on politicians and government leaders to not misuse this science and to educate the public on how it could be used in a peaceful way.
Michelle, was being a woman at the time something that made it difficult for Melba working in her field, physics, academia?
Definitely. So she got her PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, and she studied under Oppenheimer, big name there. And she went quickly from becoming his student to becoming his colleague. And they actually developed one of the staple principles of nuclear physics together. And this is the aptly named Oppenheimer-Phillips effect. And normally, such a huge accomplishment by a student at that level would have probably resulted quickly in a faculty appointment, which is what she was seeking. But it took her many years to find a permanent position. And that partially could have been, this was the 1930s, it could have been the influence of the Great Depression. But there's no question that her gender came into play.
What was Melba Phillips most known for, if we look at her life as a whole?
So I think an important thing to remember about her is that she always honored her moral principles. And this is something that many of her students cite as being unique about her. In the wake of the war and during the Red Scare, Phillips was charged with having communist leanings, which she herself says that she was apolitical, but she had been active, like we mentioned, in the peace movement and also in unionizing teachers. And this led to her being called in front of the McCarran Committee, which, you know, we all have heard of McCarthy. He's sort of the public face of the Red Scare. But the McCarran Committee was tasked with rooting out communism in academia. And so her and many other teachers were hauled in front of this and charged with communist leanings. And she, out of just her moral principles, refused to cooperate by taking the fifth, which, you know, that could make you look guilty in some people's eyes. And that is definitely how the committee spinned it. But her whole point was that she has no reason that she should cooperate with this. So she didn't, and she lost her university appointments because of that, but never regretted it. Always stuck to her moral ground.
If you're listening live right now and have any questions or comments on our program today, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That number again is 866-476-3881. Michelle, the next woman I want to talk about is Indianapolis native Harriet Bailey Kahn. What kind of work did she do in Indiana, and what's her significance?
Yeah, so she's a very important figure, and I'm happy to talk about her today. So she's really known for being sort of a pioneering or trailblazing lawyer, but was involved in a lot of different political things here within Indianapolis in the state. So like you mentioned, she's from Indianapolis, grew up here, and is her father was a prominent lawyer as well. But she graduates from Crispus Attucks at a really young age. I think she was 14 when she graduated high school, and then goes on to college in Alabama, and then graduates from IUPUI's law school, and is actually the first African-American woman graduate of the law school in 1955.
Wow, that's impressive. Wow. And can you tell us a little bit about what she did when working with the Indiana government, Jill? Like, were there any issues that she focused on?
So if I could just jump back into that a little bit here. So she, after she completes her law degree in 1955, she's, of course, admitted to the bar. And then she begins work as the deputy attorney general and does that for about a decade. And she's working on civil rights issues, extradition, state retirement funds, like a wide variety of both like corresponding and like research information, like as a deputy. And then she goes into private practice for just a couple years, but then she decides to run for the state legislature, and she's elected in November of 1966 in one of the seats for Marion County. And that first year that she runs in 1966, she's one of only six women to serve and the only African-American woman. And so she's part of the Republican Party. And then she runs for a second term. So she is elected in 66 and then obviously for 68 as well. And so during her time in the state legislature, she chairs like the House Welfare and Social Security Committee. She's a proponent of legalizing abortion to save the mother's life. She's involved in civil rights issues and various welfare support for mothers and like dependent children. So obviously she's pushing forth a lot of legislation across the board. And then after her time in the state legislature, she then is appointed by Mayor Richard Lugar to serve as assistant city attorney. And so she does that for a bit before being appointed as the state public defender in 1970. And that's probably what she's most known for is her position as state public defender, because she is not only the first woman, but also first African-American to serve in that position.
What are some of the most notable things Harriet was able to do in state government? I know you mentioned some of the things that she pushed for. Were there any things that she specifically worked on that were able to get through?
She was a champion of both personal and civil liberties. There was a lot of housing reform that she worked on. She also was a proponent of criminal justice reform. But she also, when she was a city attorney, advised the city's Human Rights Commission. Civil rights legislation obviously was a big thing for her. She was a lifelong member of the NAACP. So like she's combining a lot of things that she had been involved in over the course of her life, not only in the legislature, but then in her work for the city and as a public defender as well. And notably, the public defender's office expanded dramatically under her leadership. And so what had been a really small office, I'm sure was probably poorly funded, she was able to really expand that out over her time as state public defender.
Do enough people know about her story?
Absolutely not. No. And I feel like kind of like what Michelle was saying earlier, she was a really important figure in the 1960s and in 70s here in Indianapolis, was a champion of a lot of different causes. And sort of her story was pushed to the wayside and we don't hear about her often enough. And I feel like there's been sort of a groundswell movement over the last few years to get her story out there and sort of returned her to that position of prominence. But no, in short, people do not know about her and they need to know about her.
Absolutely. And I'm sorry. I thought somebody was saying something. let's talk about the next woman on our list here, the Queen of American Agriculture. Can you tell us who this woman was?
Yeah. So Virginia Claypool Meredith was a woman that was born in Cambridge City, Indiana, in 1848. And when she inherited her husband's farm after his death, many women would have chosen to go back to live with their families. She chose to take on the business, and she kind of inherited a mess, both the farm itself and the paperwork and the finances, and she was able to turn that around in just a couple years and make this stock breeding business one of the largest in the Midwest. And that grew her reputation as a businesswoman, as a farmer, and she began to educate other farmers through the Breeders' Gazette, through Farmers Institutes, which were these meetings all over the state, often hosted by Purdue University, where farmers educated each other on different aspects. And through these roles, then she pushed for other women to go into farming.
Was it unusual to see a woman like Virginia so involved in farming and agriculture at the time?
Definitely. So when she first became active in the Farmers Institutes, even though she was highly in demand, the board did not want to pay her. So she did that work for several years for free because some people thought that people weren't going to want to listen to what a woman had to say on farming. But for Virginia Meredith, it was always about the bottom line. So she said, you know, farming is a great occupation for women to go into, because it doesn't matter your gender. It just matters if you turn a profit or not.
That's a great quote. How would you describe the impact Virginia had on women's rights movements of the time?
Yeah, so she was supportive of women's suffrage, but she really saw her role in pushing for women to enter education, to enter farming, and she established home economics programs at the University of Minnesota and then Purdue, and she considered that her most important work because through those classes, she showed women business techniques. So not just home ec as we think of it today, but really how to organize and support a farm. So that's what she thought was the most important accomplishment. And then also she became the first female trustee at Purdue University. And if you think about what a leap from Purdue board not wanting to pay her for her work in the late 1880s to becoming the first female trustee in the 1920s, you can really see the impact that she had.
That's, yeah, you can see that times have definitely changed during her time, just from what you said. And so her relationship with Purdue, it sounds like it ended on a good note versus where she started with them, where they didn't want to pay her.
Definitely. She remained on the board until her death in the 1930s.
What impact would you say she had on education in Indiana? Is it mostly related to the farming and agriculture industry?
Yeah, the farming and agriculture industry, definitely. And then just advocating for women to go ahead and become farmers. And she told the National Council of Women in a speech trying to get women to enter these programs. She said, now, how visionary is it really to encourage women to put their energy and ability into industrial channels where earning capacity is the measure of success. So her impact in Indiana was to get women enrolled in these programs, get the education they need to run their own businesses, and hopefully follow her into farming, stock breeding, all these lucrative careers that were seen as men's fields.
Before we head to break, I want to talk about one more person, well, not one person, but a group of women called the South Bend Blue Sox. Who were these women, Michela?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I could talk about this for like 5 hours. So it's a good thing we just have a few minutes here. But so many of us are familiar with the famous Tom Hanks quote, "There's no crying in baseball," that was from the movie A League of Their Own. But fewer people know about Indiana's connection to that league. But the South Bend Blue Sox were one of the four original teams in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, which started in 1943 and lasted until 1954, and was founded by Philip K. Wrigley to, in some ways, keep baseball going during the war, but really to provide wartime entertainment and like morale boosting for families in sort of mid-sized industrial cities during World War II.
How many baseball teams, women baseball teams, were there at the time?
Right. So when the league was founded in 1943, there were four original teams, and South Bend was one of them. Over the years, it sort of expanded. I think it's max. There were, I want to say 15, but it may have been 12. A couple of points, there were eight, there were six, then it would go back up to 10. But South Bend Blue Sox existed throughout the duration of the league. But Fort Wayne also had a team that started in 1945. So obviously there's a huge Hoosier contribution there. And both teams were sort of beloved throughout the state.
I'm just wondering right now, do we often hear about women's baseball or is it softball? Because I don't know, is women's baseball still around?
So that's a really great question and one that is actually pretty complicated to answer. So women's softball has been around for a long time and was actually really popular in the 1930s. And that's sort of what Wrigley saw when he was beginning to think about putting this league together, that, you know, softball had a huge boost in popularity, but women weren't really playing baseball. Softball was actually developed as sort of a female version to play indoors and to play in cities. for men as well, but particularly for women. And so when the league first started, they were actually playing softball, but within that first season and over the next couple seasons evolved to actually playing professional baseball. And that's really been sort of the story of women in softball and baseball, where they're really pushed into playing softball as a substitute for baseball, but they're really different sports. And so you will occasionally still have like women's touring baseball teams or leagues that will pop up here and there. But mostly what you see today is women's softball.
Well, that's really interesting. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with historians about significant women in Indiana history. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam. So back now to our discussion on significant figures in Indiana women's history. We're going to go now and learn more about the women's suffrage movement in the state. With us again, two guests, Michelle Marino, Deputy Director for the Indiana Historical Bureau, and Jill Wee Simmons, Staff Historian for the Indiana Historical Bureau. Michelle, a big part of women's history in the U.S. was the suffrage movement. Were there any Hoosier women who played a large role in the movement overall?
Yeah, there's actually a lot that are pretty recognizable, and not only here throughout the state of Indiana, but then also played prominent roles in the national movement as well, and sort of buddy-buddy with some of the famous names you hear, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and others. But just, you know, a few, if we're going to name drop women here for a second, but Mary Garrett Hay is a famous suffragist from Indiana who's a longtime partner of Carrie Chapman Catt. We have a historical marker to her down in Charleston, Indiana. May Wright Sewell was a very prominent Hoosier suffragist. It was involved in education and women's clubs and in other things here throughout the state. But then involved on the national suffrage level, but then also promoting peace and other organizations to Ida Husted Harper, who writes sort of the biography, I'm not sure that's the right word, but writes the story,
overview,
something like that, of the national women's suffrage movement. So yeah, there's really prominent Hoosiers that sort of got their start here and then again sort of spread out you know, to go on speaking tours in New York and to be a part of the national organizations as well.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, yeah. I don't know that we necessarily think of Indiana when we think of the suffrage movement, because I think a lot of the historical references are to the national movement. Do you think there's more that can be done, you know, on the local levels of different states to bring prominence to some of these women?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that Dr. Anita Morgan points out in her influential book on the Indiana women's suffrage movement called We Must Be Fearless is one of the interesting things about the Indiana suffrage movement is its diversity. We see working class women and upper class women uniting. We see African-American women involved in the fight from the very beginning through the very end. Jewish women, German immigrants, and women across the political spectrum. So one of the things that we're trying to do at the Historical Bureau is place state historical markers for as many of these diverse group of women as we can. So we're starting to see a little bit of that come to fruition.
And can you tell us about this? Oh, sorry, just real quick. I'm just curious what the historical markers are. Are these like placards or something somewhere when you're going throughout the state that you'll see some commemoration?
Yeah, so the Historical Bureau is in charge of the state historical marker program, and we actually have over 700 markers across the state. So these are like big metal signs that are in the ground. There's several here on the state house lawn and on the state government complex and all over downtown Indianapolis. That just tell Hoosier stories, essentially sort of a starting point of returning the stories to the landscape and, you know, representing diverse Hoosiers and all the things they're involved in. And the program's been going on since the 1940s. So we're just really, with the centennial of women's suffrage in 2020, really hitting home that there's a lot more stories out there that we need to tell.
And it's a publicly driven program. So Hoosiers around the state can come to us and say, you know, I know about this very important woman in my community and would love to get a marker. Or even we've worked with leaders in the Indiana General Assembly and the Lieutenant Governor. And in this case, you know, they had to kind of fight to get that story of the Indiana women's suffrage movement returned to the landscape at the State House by actually passing a resolution to place it there.
Who are the women that were leading the suffrage movement for minority communities here in Indiana? Do we know who any of them were?
Yes. So as early as 1869, at the first meeting of the Indiana Women's Rights Association that was held after the Civil War, that association was established in the 1850s, is the first time that historians have been able to document African-American women's participation. We assume that they were involved from the beginning. But at this meeting, one African-American woman stood in front of this group and demanded that they assure her that Black voices would be included. The association agreed, and they remained an essential part of the fight. We know more about Black groups in Indianapolis. This really is an area where historians are doing the work right now. Our colleague Kisha Tandy at the Indiana State Museum has been leading some of this work, gathering the names of influential suffragists. But one that stands out to us is Carrie Barnes. And she was a public school teacher who helped to organize the Equal Suffrage Association, which was, I'm sure we'll get to this later, but one of two prominent suffrage associations. And in 1912, she helped organize an all-African-American branch. And the first meeting was held at the house of famous Black entrepreneur, Madam C.J. Walker. I know, I think you recently had a segment on Madam Walker. But Carrie Barnes was elected president, and there's this great quote that Dr. Morgan pulls out in her book, and she says, Carrie Barnes said, "We all feel that colored women have need for the ballot that white women have, and many, and a great many needs that they have not." And they, Black suffragists, including this branch number 7, went on to host debates at the Senate Avenue YMCA, which was really an important center for Black culture at the time, at local churches, and they worked with other suffrage groups and trade unions to forward women's rights to vote. So we're still doing the work here, but she's one that stands out to us.
If you're listening live and have any questions or comments for the program, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. Leave us a message there, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. We're talking today about significant figures in Indiana women's history in light of Women's History Month. And we're joined by Michelle Marino, Deputy Director for the Indiana Historical Bureau, and Jill Wee Simmons, Staff Historian for the Indiana Historical Bureau. Michelle, how did women of different backgrounds work together in Indiana to strengthen the suffrage movement? I guess what I'm wondering is, were they the ideal model to show us that, you know, when we all work together, we have a great accomplishment that we can do?
Yeah, so there's a lot of points to draw out on what you just said there. You know, when we think of suffragists, unfortunately, you sort of have this image of white middle-class suffragists. And there certainly were a lot of them and had been really working early on since the mid-19th century. And then again, after the Civil War, you know, pushing for women's suffrage and women's rights. But they also realized that they couldn't do it alone. And they needed women from the working class, from the labor unions, of different backgrounds and ethnicities. And so you saw that on the national level, but you also saw that here within Indiana as well.
And these women are savvy political actors with a whole range of opinions on strategy about how to achieve the vote. So some women felt like they should be working just for partial suffrage to be able to vote in local elections, for instance, and that would wedge the door open, and then they could work for further rights.
other women passionately believed that they were due their full rights as citizens and wanted to work for nothing less than full suffrage. So as you can imagine, these different groups clashed, and you know, they clashed over other issues like prohibition. And so, you know, they had some knockdown, drag down fights over this, just like male politicians were doing all the time. Sometimes when the women did it, newspapers would be critical of them, treat them as if they were being petty. But of course, they were working out strategies and working through their differences. But we do have some interesting examples of when they unite to really just push for the vote, especially once we get to like 1911, 1912.
Yeah, because they really realized in the 20th century that they needed to put pressure on all fronts. They couldn't strategically afford to put all their eggs in sort of one basket, if you will, that they had to push for a constitutional amendment, that they had to push for state amendments. You know, they're coming at it from all angles. And that really is when they realize, like, all hands on deck, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like there's just a lot going on. Would you say that they were successful by having protests here in Indiana? And if so, what kind of protests did the suffragists organize?
They came together several times. There were two main suffrage groups, the Women's Franchise League and the Equal Suffrage Association, as we mentioned, differing over strategy, but they would come together to show their force, to show the suffrage movement was not a fringe movement. It's not just a few extremists calling for the vote, that Hoosier women were demanding the vote. And one of my favorite examples is in 1913, when those two suffrage groups came together. There were several votes at the State House happening on this day in March in 1913. And they knew that they were probably not going to pass. In fact, by the time they got there, one had already been withdrawn. But that was not the point of this march. 500 women marched silently into the State House to show their leaders that they were united, and knowing that they were probably going to be denied suffrage that day, to make that these politicians look them in the face and deny them their rights while they stood there. And one interesting thing about this, because they marched in silence, because this wasn't, a demonstration, this was a protest. Because they marched in silence, the newspapers actually accused them of not understanding what was going on. So when one of the bills was voted down and they didn't, there wasn't some huge uproar, the newspaper said, oh, they obviously didn't understand. But our research has shown that they actually penned the bill. Of course, a male legislator had to introduce it, but one of the suffrage groups actually wrote the bill that was being introduced. So their silence was meant to convey their disapproval, their unity, and to make their presence felt in that moment.
What did opposition to the suffrage movement look like here in Indiana?
Well, kind of like it looked everywhere else, too. It could be from various classes and various groups of people. There were some organizations of like anti-suffragists, but mostly they'd be ridiculed in the papers. You'd get people, you know, that would come out and say, well, I don't need the vote. My husband can vote for me. I trust my father to make these decisions. But in some ways, there's just a lot of misinformation about sort of what they wanted and what their goals were. And there was just fear about what this would mean.
One of the things that is really fun, if you look through some of the newspapers at the time, is suffragists, women that were pro-suffrage, pretending to be anti-suffrage and having these debates to show how ridiculous that position was, to show that, you know, even if you're anti-suffrage, like there must be something you believe in, like maybe better schools or more parks. Well, at a certain point, you're going to hit that catch 22 of, we can't achieve our rights because we can't influence our legislators because we don't have the vote. So,
and suffragists would use that specific line of argument. I'm glad you brought that point up, Jill, because They would use their roles as wives and mothers to sort of counter the anti-suffrage thing. Like, we can't be as effective mothers as we need to be if we can't protect our children, if we can't make sure that they're eating clean food and drink and are protected at school and these things, if we can't control sort of our own destiny via the ballot.
How do you think things stand now if we look back to all of these movements and things that women did to gain their rights and whatnot? How do you think things look now? Was all of that valuable or was it for waste?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is at the first women's rights convention that was in Dublin in Wayne County, Indiana, in 1851, the small group that met there passed resolutions that we would recognize as fights that are still going on today. They called for equal access to employment and education and equal pay for equal work. You know, we're still fighting for these things.
And I think the point that I would make here, too, on top of what Jill just said, is that the fight wasn't simply over when they got the right to vote. And many of the women at the time knew that. But not only in Indiana, but particularly in the South, but also in Indiana, you know, a lot of Black women were quickly disenfranchised. Native American women still didn't have the right to vote. Asian American women still didn't have right to vote till the mid, you know, 20th century. And, you know, it didn't mean that women were equal across the board for those very reasons that Jill just listed, some of the issues they were fighting for. So the vote was a huge, important step forward, and it was absolutely critical, but that did not solve everything. And I think the women quickly realized that, and many of them shifted to continue fighting through a variety of different means.
As we get ready to wrap up here, we have about a minute left. I'm curious to hear from each of you where people can go to learn more about the women we've talked about and others.
Yeah, so two main ways we would encourage people to go to the Historical Bureau website, in.gov/history, and click on the map there of all the historical markers and see if there's an important woman by you whose story you don't know, and or if you know of one and we don't, please let us know. We're trying to get these markers, these stories returned to the landscape. And then also we have a podcast called Talking Hoosier History. And, you know, we mentioned Melba Phillips and the South Bend Blue Sox. Those are both really fun podcast episodes.
And we also have a couple of suffrage episodes that go into a little bit more depth about some of the stories that Jill and I just shared. And to reiterate, too, we know that this work is not done. We're constantly, you know, trying to deep dive into original research and primary sources and craft stories for our blog to, again, get the word out. But we're also still working on marker projects. We have, you know, a list of about 15 or so women that we think their stories still need to be told. And so we're always looking for community partners to do that work with us. And so, again, we encourage people to reach out via email, via our website, via our social media to help us do the work.
Well, thank you both so much. Michelle Marino, Deputy Director for the Indiana Historical Bureau, and Jill Wee Simmons, Staff Historian for the Indiana Historical Bureau. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.